So I put the word real in quotes here because, you know, anyone who's ever worked in the optics lab, that becomes their entire world. So what I mean by real in this case is taking quantum information outside the lab into the city, into a dirty environment, and trying to make things work there. And you end up with some nasty problems that I'll talk about. So as Ephraim said, I'm at the Institute for Quantum Computing, and basically this institute was founded at Waterloo a few years ago. Waterloo's on a map of Ontario is here. So for you guys, you know, you're here, and Ossington Street's about there. So it's, if you never go west of Ossington, which is the standard for Toronto people, you know, you have to imagine there is a world out here, and we're in it. Anyway, yeah, you know. So we've got about 14 faculty right now, a few postdocs, and quite a few students, and we're always looking for more. So if any of this work is interesting to you, please contact me. That's all I want to say about poaching your students. So optical quantum information, I kind of break it down into several different areas, and I'm interested in basically all of these areas. So quantum information, basically the idea here is to use the quantum states of light and matter to gain advantages in computation, in communication, specifically in security, and in the precision measurements. Now, in optics, we also have this field, nonlinear optics, and basically this is a way to get photons to start to interact with each other. So we use atoms to mediate the interactions, and that's this field, nonlinear optics. And then we're also interested in sort of foundational questions, things like non-locality, and topics like that. For this talk, I'm just going to talk about two of these areas. I'm going to talk about some work that I did in quantum computation, specifically something called one-way quantum computation, which you may or may not have heard of, but at the end of this talk, you'll have heard of it. And the second area is some work that I did in real-world long-distance quantum communication. So quantum information is basically based on the idea that we can have quantum bits, which are like bits that we're used to, these two-state systems that can be in state zero, one of two different states, excuse me, zero or one. But quantum mechanics allows those bits to be in superposition states, alpha zero plus beta one. And typical examples that people like to talk about, especially optics people, are photon polarization. This is an example of a physical implementation of a qubit. Or we can talk about different atomic levels, or we can talk about spins. There are all kinds of ways of encoding quantum information in physical systems. And basically, once you do that, you get to take advantage of sort of familiar quantum features, things you learn about, like the uncertainty principle, that there are pairs of observables that can't both be specified to an arbitrary precision at the same time. Another way of looking at that is the so-called no-cloning theorem, where it's impossible to make a perfect copy of a quantum state. Basically, the linearity of quantum mechanics doesn't allow you to make copies of quantum states arbitrarily. So this is the mathematical symbol for you can't do this. So it turns out if you take those two properties together, as Bennett and Broussard did back in the 80s, you very quickly lead to the ultimate cryptosystem. So the idea is very simple. You send, in this setup, we have some source of single photons, and we have some polarizers where we can select one of four states to send. And basically, the idea is that you send photons prepared in the eigenstates of one of two non-commuting sets of observables. So you can think of horizontal and vertical polarization as sending an X, if you like, and 45 minus 45 is sending a P. Now, if an eavesdropper comes along and tries to make measurements about the state, you can't do this without making some kind of disturbance. So if he tries to make measurement of X, he's going to disturb P, for example. another way of looking at this is if that same eavesdropper tries to take those states and make lots of copies so they can send one on and make measurements on the rest that they have, they're not able to do that because of the no cloning theorem. So either strategy, either kind of eavesdropping strategy is going to lead to errors that the receiver is going to detect, and the sender and receiver can decide not to send a message. We have more quantum features such as the superposition principle. And I've stolen this from one of Ephraim's talks. Basically, a quantum system can be in many different states at the same time through a quantum superposition. And we also have the familiar interference feature. Basically, if there are two ways that, in this case, light can get to a slit, we have to add the amplitudes for those two processes, and then quantum phases come in, which determine these bright spots and dark spots. And if you take those two properties together, we end up with much more powerful computers. These were some ideas based on the work of Feynman and Deutsch back in the 80s as well. So basically, a normal computer computes a function by taking some input state to an output state, whereas a quantum computer can take this superposition of all possible input states to a superposition of all possible output states. So in some sense, you've got massive parallelism. The only problem is that when you come along to make a measurement, you end up with just a random result, right? You just pick out one of those terms. Except that people have come up with very clever algorithms which take advantage of this other feature of quantum mechanics, interference, which makes all the wrong answers basically interfere destructively and all the right answers interfere constructively. So the probability of getting a right answer is dramatically increased. And you may have heard about Shor's fast algorithm for factoring or Grover's quantum search algorithm. I'm going to talk about Grover's algorithm a little bit later. But what features prominently in quantum communication and quantum computation are so-called entangled states. And basically, they're states that don't look like this. So if you have some state of two systems, if you can write it in the form of system one, separate from system two, then this is a state that's not entangled. A famous example of an entangled state is a so-called Bell state, which looks like this, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. Basically, the states are perfectly correlated. And it turns out a state like this you can't write as the state of qubit 1 on its own and the state of qubit 2 on its own. And we'll see how to use these entangled states and some more general kinds of entangled states in the experiments that I'm going to talk about. Now, in optics, there's all kinds of ways to actually encode quantum information. So I already mentioned polarization. Polarization is a nice natural two-level system. We've got the horizontal polarization and the vertical polarization. And different superpositions, you can think of the symmetric superposition as a diagonally polarized photon. You can have circularly polarized light, which is a superposition with an I phase shift. But we can encode quantum information in all kinds of different degrees of freedom of light. So one example that has some advantages, especially in fibers where polarization isn't necessarily maintained as the light travels through the fiber, is time bin encoding. Basically, there's one of two different times that are the two distinguishable states in which to encode your qubits. We can also imagine encoding in spatial modes. So here are some pictures of some transverse modes. And you can also imagine using just the path that the photon is traveling on. And some work has even been done on encoding quantum information in frequencies, so using two different energies as basis states. Now, I've mentioned that you can encode quantum information in several systems. You can encode it in optics, but you can also encode it in spins or atoms. Photons, as it turns out, has some good properties, bad, and some really ugly properties. So here's sort of a list of the good properties. If, especially if you're working with polarization, it's very easy to do single qubit operations. We've got wave plates that allow us to manipulate the polarization arbitrarily. Photons don't interact with things very strongly, so there's a sort of natural long decoherence time. And this is important if you want to send quantum information over appreciable distances. Now, it's also important that photons move pretty fast. So you can travel, you can go long distance in a short time. So in a sense, these things together, well, especially these two, make photons the perfect carriers of quantum information. Now, the bad list, well, things are starting to get a little negative. It's very easy to lose photons. They scatter off of glass or and whatnot. But this is a real pain. So photons don't naturally interact with the environment, so there's low decoherence, but they also don't naturally interact with themselves. So we need to turn to nonlinearities to get photons to effectively interact, but these generally are very, very weak. Now, I put under the ugly here, there are some schemes to get around the fact that there are no natural interactions or strong nonlinearities for photons to effectively interact. These are so-called linear optics methods for building scalable quantum computers. And it turns out that the overhead for not having nonlinear effects makes things very complicated very quickly. And basically, you need 50 to thousands of elements to do even a simple two-qubit gate. So the work that I'm going to be talking about today is based on a process called parametric downconversion. And if any of you want to see this in action, I suggest that you go and visit Ephraim Steinberg's lab. And basically, the idea behind it is you have a laser beam, which is full of blue photons, and those photons pass through a kind of crystal that has a chi-2, has a second-order susceptibility. And those blue photons can sometimes break into two red photons. And these red photons are constrained by basically energy conservation and momentum conservation, what the nonlinear optics people call phase matching. So the energy and momentum conservation create kind of natural entanglement in time or momentum and position. But it turns out that there's an orientation of crystal that was invented by Paul Quiet, which uses so-called type 2 down conversion to generate polarization entanglement. And the way it works is depicted here. You may have seen the famous picture of these rings sort of taken straight on. But the idea is that with this type 2 phase matching, all of the cones to the left, this cone, that cone, and this big red cone, all the photons on there are horizontally polarized. And all of the photons on the right side, on these cones, are vertically polarized. So if a photon comes out here, by momentum conservation, the other photon has to come out here. Now, these guys don't know which cone that they're on. They're confused. They're not sure whether they're supposed to be horizontal or vertical. But they know that if one of them comes out here and it's horizontal, then the other one has to be vertical and vice versa. And it turns out that the photons emitted at these crossing points, and these green cones are meant to represent degenerate energies, come out in this nice entangled state, which looks very similar to that Bell state that I wrote up before. So to give you an idea of what one of these sources can look like in the lab, this is a small source that we used in some of the experiments that I'm going to tell you about. Basically, this doesn't look like much, but we've got the laser. So this is the source of the blue light. Goes on this wiggly path. This is a nonlinear crystal, which just looks like a little piece of glass, basically. And the red light here is the down-converted light that gets emitted at a slight angle relative to the pump, which gets sort of straightened up with the axis of the table and coupled into these single-mode fibers. So this is much larger than life-size. This whole thing is basically sort of the meter length scale. So it can be a very compact setup. Now, there have been some advancements, and I'm not sure that these qualify as recent anymore. But basically, there are UV laser diodes that are basically, in many cases, have replaced the need for big argon lasers in these kinds of experiments. And they're much cheaper. They're very easy to use, and you know they're cheap enough that you could build an experiment to put in the undergraduate lab. And this is something that I'm very interested in doing. There's been some work in the last few years on trying to couple down-converted light very efficiently into single-mode fibers. And this is especially important for the long-distance work because you need to have light in a very well-defined spatial mode in order for it to propagate with low divergence over long distances. And basically, in slightly different setups involving pulse lasers, which I will get to, this down conversion can be, these photon pairs can be entangled once again to make 4, 5, and even very recently 6 photon entangled states. And this is particularly nice because the entanglement is controllable. You can get in there and make measurements on each photon individually to start probing the entanglement in these setups, in these systems. So basically, here's I think an interesting plot. Basically, down conversion sources have just been steadily improving like crazy. So this is the entangled pair detected, the detected entangled pair rate over the last few years, and the improvements in the sources have just been enabling all kinds of new experiments. Particularly the number of photons that can get entangled have been, so here's back in the 70s with these atomic cascade and 3, 4, 5, and 6 photon experiments have been coming with quite regularly over the last few years. So the first kinds of experiments that I want to talk about are these quantum communication experiments, basically where some sender, Alice, wants to communicate with some receiver, Bob, using a quantum resource of some type. And I should say that, so this work was done in the Zeilinger group. So here's Anton here, and I've circled. I think I got everyone in this picture who was involved in the free space projects that I'm going to talk about. But several people aren't there, and specifically Harold Weinfurter was one of our collaborators and several of his students, and then some people who joined the group after this picture was taken. So I already mentioned this. So basically, there's some challenges with distributing entanglement. So photons are great; they're great carriers. But the problems that we run into are here. Basically, because you can't clone quantum states, you can't amplify lost quantum states. You have to be able to send entanglement from the sender to the receiver with high efficiency. And the problems that we run into because we're dealing with single photons is that the background rejection has to be very good. So in a first experiment, what we did was we put the source that I showed you on one bank of the Danube River. And we had a receiver on the other side and also on the same side, but significantly far away. So this link was 0.5 kilometer, and this link is 150 kilometers. Meters. and we put the source in this funny-looking box. So, I mean, we don't have a lab on the side of the Danube. So we just put this shipping container and stuck the source and two students in there and some coffee and donuts. And there was some fibers that came out of this, and that basically, because we could couple the light into those fibers, those are now that's how we got the entangled photons out of the box. And we had these really cheap telescopes, which were basically just a fiber coupler and a lens. On the receiver side, we had a polarizer so we could make polarization measurements. Now, on each side here and here, we had some detectors, and we took the detected signal here, and we happened by some stroke of luck to have a 1 kilometer long BNC cable to take the pulses from this detector over here, where we could do coincidence measurements, much like Ephraim does in his lab. You have two detectors, two clicks, you put them into a box, and you ask when they both fire at the same time. Now, obviously, here there's some significant time delay from going from the source to this side through the big long cable, but that can be compensated for by a delay. So what we did is basically a Bell experiment. And the way these work is as following. So there's some source, typically in order to get something interesting, of entangled pairs. And on one side, there's a measurement device that can be set in one of two ways. It can be set to setting A, or it can be set to setting A prime. On the other side, there's a measurement device that can be set to setting B or setting B prime. And in the end, you get either a click. You get a click up here, plus one, or a click down here, minus one. So in this particular example, I don't know, say this was set to setting A, and this was set to, we got measurement outcome plus one, and this was set to B, and we got measurement outcome minus one, something like that. So you repeat this many, many times. Now, it turns out that if you imagine that the particles leaving this have some local properties, basically they leave the source, and they've got a list of what they're going to do when they get to the measurement apparatus. So this would be one example of a set of local properties. So, all right, so the particle going here says, all right, if I see setting A, I'm going to give plus one. If I see setting A prime, I'm going to go to the minus one. And similarly, the particle going this way has, it's pre-decided what it's going to do if it hits B or B prime. And there's an identity. If you just think about this, if each of these numbers has to be plus or minus one corresponding to these measurement results, then this particular combination of observables has to be plus or minus two. Basically, either B plus B prime is going to be two, and this will be zero, or vice versa. And basically, that's all the CHSH Bell inequality is. So if you take the average value from doing this experiment a whole bunch of times, take the absolute value to make things simpler, then the average has to be less than or equal to 2, because you're just averaging a bunch of numbers that are either plus or minus 2. But strangely enough, quantum mechanics allows this particular combination of observables for the right kind of state and the right kind of measurements to be larger. It allows it to be as large as 2 root 2. So we have to throw out this assumption that the particles leaving the source have these local properties. So what we do in our experiment to verify that the sender and the receiver share entanglement is to specifically test one of these Bell inequalities by making the right set of measurements with polarizers on at the two receivers. So when we do that for the right set of measurements, we find that S is larger than 2 by 4 standard deviations. So anything larger than 2 indicates entanglement, and we're pretty sure that we violated the Bell inequality and measured entanglement. So in this experiment, we had the two links, 500 meters and 100 or 150 meters, and we were limited to about 10 coincidences per second. And basically, I don't know how many of you have tried to align single mode to single mode fibers in the lab, but it's kind of a pain. Doing it over 500 meters over walkie-talkie in German is even harder. So we use the single mode fibers to try and get the background reduced, so we didn't get a lot of light from the background. I should mention we did the experiment at night, but even so, we were really worried about background. That's why we used this. It turns out that this was not terribly clever, and we rectified it in the experiment I'm going to talk about. But what we also had, because of that big long cable, we had a nice time-stable channel. Basically, if I got a click at one side, another click popped out the cable on the other side at four microseconds later. That was, kind of a feature of this experiment. Now, taking this to the next step, we wanted to, we got a little bit cocky, actually. So we thought, okay, let's go from 500 meters up to almost 8 kilometers. And we chose this distance because we wanted to do an experiment over an atmospheric equivalent. Basically, if you go straight up, you have about 7.3 kilometers worth of air at the density that we have at the on the ground. So we wanted to go longer than that distance as a kind of proof of principle that you could send quantum entanglement through a whole atmosphere of air, say up to a satellite. And what we did is we got rid of the, we didn't have a nice 8 kilometer long BNC cable in this case, so we had to get rid of that, which meant some experimental complications. And then as part of the real world aspect, we wanted to do the experiment in a likely scenario. So we passed the light over a city, Vienna, it was convenient. So here's a picture of the redesigned telescope. Basically, we have a huge lens, but the design is very similar to what we had in the first experiment. Basically, this is a fiber coupler. The light comes out from the source that's now inside a nice building, which is a little nicer than the shipping container. The light expands out and gets collimated by this lens. Now, what we had to kind of deal with, which we didn't have in the first experiment too much, was the consequence of the atmosphere. So the Free Space 1 experiment all took place down here at the Danube. And we tried a sort of test run over the river, just up the river a little bit. And I don't know if you can see this, but there are two bridges on the Danube, and basically you get a nice straight line between them that are about 4 kilometers apart. And just to give you an idea what we saw when we tried that. So this picture, it's going to be a bit hard to see, but there's two lines here. One is a bar. It's just a shadow from a bar on this bridge here. And the other side is the bottom little stem from Toronto Maple Leaf hockey jersey. So that gives you, that's our ruler, because everybody knows how big that is, right? So it's about an inch, right? And you can see that just from the atmosphere, the laser beam starts wandering around and fluctuating. Basically on the scale of, this beam size is probably about 10, 15 centimeters and the wander's about the same size. Now, I should mention that was really good. When we actually did our experiment, we were going over a longer distance and we were also going over a city, either in the winter when everybody had their chimneys on, or in the summer when the city heats up during the day and basically looks like a barbecue at night. So that kind of beam wander was really quite good. What we did is, instead of just having a single port in the output, just measuring the light that gets transmitted through a polarizer, we redesigned the receiver modules basically to measure 4 polarizations at once. So there's another big lens here. The light came in and hit a beam splitter. So the photon makes kind of a random choice whether it's going to go that way or this way. If it goes up, it gets measured in the horizontal vertical basis. And if it goes straight through, there's a wave plate that rotates it, and we measure in the 45 minus 45 basis. And each output has a multimode fiber to send light to the detectors. Now, why would we do this? Well, the basic idea is to do something like the secure Bennett-Broussard cryptography protocol that I talked about first, but in the absence of good single photon sources. So what some people do is use weak laser pulses to sort of simulate single photon sources, but this has a problem. Either you need Pockel cells to rotate the polarization to send one of the 4 states, the X and P states, or the HV plus 45 minus 45 states, or what's typical is that people use 4 different lasers. But the problem is that if the laser frequencies don't all coincide, then that's an additional degree of freedom that you're not aware of that could contain some distinguishing information, which is bad for cryptography. So the idea is to use an entangled state from one of these down-conversion crystals and let quantum mechanics randomly make prepare a state for you. So if you just send one photon into this measurement device, you're going to get a click at one of these detectors at random. If you look at that state, that entangled state, HH plus VV, and write it in the 45 minus 45 basis, you see it looks basically the same. The photons are perfectly correlated in that 45 minus 45 basis. So basically, whenever one of these detectors fires, say an H detector fires, then the other photon's in H. If the 45 fires, then the other photon's in 45. So you just passively are preparing one of those four states randomly, and you don't have to worry about watching the laser frequencies. You also have to worry less about the Poissonian statistics of a laser beam. Basically, there's a high probability if you're just sending laser pulses that there are two photons in one pulse, and that's another security loophole. So anyway, in our particular experiment, so I already mentioned that we did this experiment was over about 8 kilometers. I hope I have a better picture than that here. So the way it worked is we just did a single link this time, not the two links. So the source was located in this observatory, and we did one of the measurements locally. So basically, the light came straight out into one of those four output detectors. The other photon was sent through the telescope that I showed you across the city, and basically we had a receiver station high up in this skyscraper. And this is a whole picture. This is a picture of the whole experiment. So Alice locally makes one measurement, sends the photon over to Bob at this building, and the because we don't have this time stable channel anymore, not only the fact that a detection event occurred is recorded, but also the time at which that detection is recorded. So we have a time record of all of the clicks at our detectors, and that data is sent via the internet back to the source, and basically just in software, the two sets of data are lined up through a correlation to determine the coincident pairs. So we do coincidences without a time stable channel, just using instead time tagging and the internet. So here's the picture that I showed you. It was in the colloquium ad, and this is basically a view from the roof. So this is our sending telescope, and that's a 46-story building. Just looks like a little toy, 8 kilometers away. So that's where we were sending the light. So in this particular experiment, we didn't do the cryptography, but rather measured this Bell inequality again. So by inserting a wave plate at the receiver, we could change our measurements from HV 45 minus 45. We could just rotate them a little bit to the settings that you need to test this Bell inequality. And here's the result that we got here. So again, we were higher than 2, so we could show that the entanglement had survived. And again, we did a two-link experiment. One was 8 kilometers and one was a little bit shorter. But our count rate was better. So we had 25 counts per second, basically because we were monitoring all possible channels at the same time. What was different about the receivers is that we had this, instead we got rid of this single mode fiber to single mode fiber, and we just used a spatial filter instead, which really, I mean, we would have killed us to use single mode. Anyway, these results were published a couple years ago. So there's quite a few challenges remaining in quantum communication. Obviously, going to longer distances and getting the bit rates as high as possible is important. I should mention that Anton's group, since I left, has gone and done similar kinds of experiments up to 150 kilometers, not over a city, because that's bigger than a city, but between two mountains on two islands in the Atlantic. The idea is it would be nice to compensate for the atmospheric fluctuations with some sort of adaptive optics. an important problem is to try and get quantum interference over long distance to try and build quantum repeaters. Now, these are devices to help compensate for the loss and for decoherence over long distance. And here's a couple other things, doing cryptography and trying to hit moving targets. I should mention that IQC has its own free space experiment, and it's being run by Gregor Weiss and Ray Laflamme with their graduate student Chris Irvin. And the idea is to use free space links on the order of about a kilometer to set up quantum cryptography between the IQC building and the Perimeter Institute that runs continuously. So the second topic that I want to talk about has to do with quantum computation instead of communication. And I'm going to talk about a kind of alternative model for quantum computation that you probably haven't heard of as much as the sort of standard model. So here's the mob that I worked with here. This is Philip Balter, who's now a postdoc at Harvard. Many of you might know Terry Rudolph. He looks like this in real life. Terry was a lecturer here for a while. Vladko Vedral, Harold Weinfurter, Marcus Aspelmeyer, and Anton Zeilinger. So the one-way model is kind of a different strategy for trying to build a quantum computer. So on the left here, this is the standard circuit model for quantum computing. And basically the idea here is that you have a bunch of qubits, and you start off by initializing them all to the ground state or to the zero state. Then you do some big unitary transformation on those qubits, and that the specific choice of unitary is basically the computer program. It's the algorithm that you run, and in the end, you just measure, say in the computational basis, what the outcome is, 1, 0, 1, 1, something like that. Now the one-way model works very differently, and this model was invented by Robert Rausendorf and Hans Briegel from Innsbruck. Robert's now a postdoc at the Perimeter Institute, and I should mention that it's now considered the most promising route to quantum computation in terms of the amount of resources required in linear optics, thanks to the work of Mike Nielsen, who is moving to Canada in the summer, and also Dan Brown, not the author, and Terry Rudolph. So the idea here is, instead of initializing the qubits all to the ground state, you prepare this big cluster state. And cluster states are generally drawn as these kind of graphs where each point in the cluster represents a physical qubit. Now, I'll explain a little bit more what these graphs actually mean. But the idea is that it's a big entangled state. So it's an entangled state of a lot of qubits. The algorithm, instead of running as a unitary transformation, so this reversible thing, actually runs by measurements and single qubit measurements. So basically, all of the qubits on the leftmost side are you just measure them. You just do projective measurements. And the specific choices of measurements that you make encodes the computer program or algorithm. And then the readout is basically the same as in the circuit model. You just measure the states of the last qubits. So how does this work? Well, let's take I'll first explain what these graphs mean. So the idea is that if you have you start off with your qubits, the sort of points or in that graph initialized to the plus state. So the plus state is the symmetric superposition of 0 plus 1, basically, equal amplitude state. And the bars in this cluster state represent entanglement, and they represent a very certain, very specific kind of entanglement. So basically, to go from this graph where the qubits aren't connected to this graph where they are, you apply a C-phase operation. And a C-phase is a kind of two-qubit gate where basically these are your initial states. 0,0 goes to 0,0, 0,1 goes to 0,1, da da da, and the 1,1 goes to -1,1. So it looks pretty innocent, but it turns out that if you apply this C phase to these two qubits, which are initially in a separable state, then you generate a state that looks like this, that's entangled. It looks like the Bell state. Basically, it's 0 plus, plus 1 minus, and 0 and 1 are orthogonal, and plus and minus are orthogonal. So it's actually basically exactly equivalent to that Bell state. And you can imagine building bigger cluster states by having more qubits starting off in the plus state and applying more C phase operations. So this is an example of a 4-qubit, what we call the horseshoe cluster. Now, these things can be used to process information. So if you imagine that the first qubit starts off in a state psi and the second qubit's just in this generic plus state, and you apply this C phase to form a cluster state, you entangle these in some way. So in some sense, the information doesn't reside on qubit 1 or qubit 2 anymore. It resides in their correlations. And you come along and you measure qubit 1 in some basis, and the basis is some funny-looking thing. It's an equal amplitudes between 0 and 1, but there's a phase, and I've left out the normalization. This phase factor, alpha, is the control knob that you have to determine the algorithm that you run. Now, there's a step that I didn't mention. Basically, measurements in quantum mechanics are random in general. So if you find a 0, you don't do anything to the second qubit. If you find a 1 instead, then you have to apply a not, or a sigma x operation. And this is what people call feed forward. You have to take the result from the measurement and do something with it to the qubit. And then the final state of the qubit is your initial state rotated by some angle alpha about along the equator of the Bloch sphere, and then there's this funny Hadamard operation. But there's an equivalent quantum circuit to what we just did. Basically, this state psi goes through one operation with this rotation angle alpha that was encoded in our measurement, and then another single qubit gate. Now, the idea of this model is that if you have a bigger cluster state, something like this, then the number of columns here determines the number of operations that you can do, and the number of rows determines the number of encoded qubits. So, for example, this computation has 4 rows, so it's a 4-qubit computation with basically 3 clock cycles and a readout. So we made cluster states in the lab. I don't have a lot of time to talk about exactly how it worked, but basically we used a down conversion source with a pulse laser to make 2 passes through this crystal, which created photon pairs in the forward and back direction. And then we used the properties of polarizing beam splitters to entangle those photons further. Basically, if you imagine 2 horizontally polarized photons going into this beam splitter, they can both go through. If you imagine 2 vertically polarized photons, they both get reflected. But if you have 2 that are differently polarized, then they both go the same way. So if you have detectors in this output and in this output, the polarizing beam splitter does a kind of projective measurement onto the symmetric subspace of horizontal, horizontal, and vertical, vertical. So this is for the experts, I guess, this is the a reconstruction of the state that we made, this 4-photon cluster state. This is the theoretical density matrix written in the horizontal and vertical basis, and this is the reconstructed method matrix that we measured in the lab using quantum state tomography, and the fidelity is about 63%, which isn't very high for 2-qubit states, but there wasn't much to compare it to for 4-qubit states. It turns out that this fidelity, even though it's low, this state was able to do computations, which I'll show you, which were very, very, very high quality. But basically, there are 2 rules that you need to go from clusters to circuits. If you have a bar in the horizontal direction, you get this rotation that I showed you before. If you have a bar in the vertical direction, then you get a 2-qubit entangling gate in the equivalent circuit model, something like this is the C phase operation that I showed you, followed by two single qubit rotations. All right, and the alpha, this corresponds to the measurement here. Beta corresponds to the measurement here. So what we did with our, we basically made one cluster state, this linear four qubit cluster. But the different order of measurements allowed us to do multiple circuits with that same cluster. So if we measured the qubits linearly, 1, 2, 3, 4, then we did a single qubit computation with, and it's hard to see, but basically it's a one qubit computation with three gates that we could control. If instead we measured the two inner qubits first or the two outer qubits first, then we had a computation with fewer measurements that we could control, but now it's a two-qubit computation instead of one. And it turns out by some funny coincidence that this box cluster, which has an extra bar, is basically equivalent to one of these if you just flip a couple of the qubits around. You have to take my word for it. And that gives you an extra, that extra bar gives you an extra two-qubit gate. So we were able to do single and two-qubit operations in that cluster. The fidelity is about 90% and 80% with what's expected, much higher than the state fidelity. I don't have time to get into this, but It turns out, and if you want to talk to me about this after, that one of the circuits corresponding to this box cluster is equivalent to Grover's algorithm, this fast quantum search algorithm for two qubits. So here's the results that we published in our paper, where we were able to implement this algorithm with 90% correct computational output. So I'm just going to skip this. I'd just like to summarize, because I see it's almost 5 o'clock, and I know I used to hate it when people went over. So I've talked about two different experiments. One took place in the real world, taking quantum information outside, and these were the first experiments demonstrating free space entanglement distribution. And then I've also talked about some of the ideal world experiments in the optics lab, where we demonstrated the first cluster state quantum computing using this four photon cluster, including the first algorithm, Grover's quantum search. So thank you very much for your attention, and thanks for the invitation.
Thank you for a very nice talk and possibly the first colloquium this year to end before 5 o'clock. Are there any questions? Kevin?
So there was a slide towards the end of the first part where you talked about lighting these down conversion sources instead of lasers to make like a single photon probability. And you said that you suppressed two photon probabilities somehow. I thought that down conversion sources may also contain two photons.
Yeah, they can.
No.
Well, they do contain a two-photon component, but it's much smaller. If you make a
Sorry? It's suppressed relative to Poisson statistics.
Yeah. Well, you're at much lower rates, basically. So you can make a...
Well, you can attenuate a coherent state.
Well, that's true. But you have this conditional preparation. You have a measurement that tells you whether there's a photon in that other...
Well, I see how that gets rid of vacuum, but not that...
Can we talk about it after? A quantum repeater uses something called uses a few things. It uses something called entanglement swapping, which is a method of taking two pairs of entangled photons and doing some kind of measurement to. So if you have two pairs of photons that are entangled, this photon here is not entangled with this one. But if you do a joint measurement on this pair, it's called a Bell state measurement, you can entangle these photons. So it uses this process, and it uses something called quantum state purification or entanglement purification to boost the entanglement loss by decoherence. So it doesn't directly amplify a quantum state, but it allows for, with these two processes, it allows for entanglement to be distributed over much larger distances. But it's not as simple as a straight amplifier in a standard, internet network.
inside satellite communications, why would you want to do free space communication? Fiber optics seem weatherproof.
Well, it turns out that both, without these quantum repeaters, both free space and fibers have roughly the same distance that they can go up to. People have done calculations that you shouldn't be able to go much further than about 150 kilometers, basically what both both camps have demonstrated. So it shouldn't be possible to go much further. To go much further, you need to go to satellite. So other advantages would be that sometimes you don't have a fiber laid. So free space equipment can be transported more easily. You don't have to lay a fiber where there isn't already one.
Is 150 kilometers still the limit with equipment?
I'm not sure. That's certainly not included in the in some of the works that Yamamoto was doing to work on these limits. But is Hoi Kwong or any of his students here? Can you answer that question? Can you get to an order of magnitude higher than 150 kilometers? Or okay. Well, I know that, for example, Anton's group in that 150 kilometer long free space experiment has done decoy state, but I don't know if they've gone much further.
Describe in more detail the prospects and plans of going into space for the satellite experiment.
It's not something that I'm not really an expert on that, and it's not something that I'm pursuing. So, no.
Daniel's answer is always better. He's just not allowed to tell us.
Yeah.
Other questions? Is it back somewhere? No luck in the back.
What's really going on? Next level that you work in this field as a captain. What are your thoughts about what's actually happening below just the quantum mechanics of the force of the ocean?
When I think about that too hard, my head starts to hurt. That's all I could say. Well, there's just so many problems with trying to impose our classical worldview on the quantum systems that sometimes the shut up and calculate mentality is actually the best route for sanity.
Another question, Mr. I was thinking, do you use like a trusted eavesdrop instead of sort of amplifier? Like, you know that somebody is taking your line, and you trust that person, and you just propagate things that way?
Yeah, and So, one way to do it is to have, as you say, trusted repeater stations, which measure the information and regenerate it. That kind of thing is certainly possible. Well, it depends. Depends how much you trust your repeaters.
The nice thing about the quantum repeaters is you don't have to trust. Well, trust and verify. You can actually confirm that you've distributed entanglement, and then you no longer need to trust. So it should save you that much.
Well, obviously the data rate is not up to the full speed of a non-encrypted fiber. Is there some fundamental limit on the rate at which you can send this secure data?
Well, I mean, there's some practical limits, but I don't think as long as your detectors are fast and your source is bright, then you should be able to ramp it up. I mean, loss is going to be a big practical problem, but there's no real reason, no.
What's data right now?
In In the experiments that they're continuing to do? Well, they've gone to longer distances, so I think they're actually lower than what we got in the city. In the first experiment, it was about 10 counts per second, and in the second, about 25, so tens of hertz. But people have done experiments at much higher rates, where the goal, not using entanglement, for example, using faint laser pulses, where kilohertz are possible. It depends on the distance.
Any other questions? Thank you one more time.